final speaker is Bonnie McRae from the University of Connecticut, and Bonnie is going to speak to the evaluation issues and design and challenges of the ESPER project. Bonnie?
Thanks. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the design, SAMHSA's ESPER cross-site evaluation efforts. Oh, sorry. No financial disclosures. I am one of many folks who have taken part in this large cross-site evaluation efforts. We do have four partners that are the cross-site evaluation, make up the cross-site evaluation team. Members from RTI International, JVS International, which is a corporation in Maryland, the University of Connecticut Health Center, and the ABISA Group from Berkeley, California. Our principal investigator, our research director, is Dr. Jeremy Bray, who was not able to be here today. My objective today is to briefly describe the ESPER cross-site evaluation design, including the process evaluation components, economic evaluation, and the patient outcomes. But I would particularly like to focus on the process evaluation design and methodology and share a little bit about the preliminary findings from the process evaluation for the first cohort of ESPER grantees. Again, as you heard from Jack and others, SAMHSA's initiative was designed to help expand grantees' continuum of care to including screening, brief intervention, and referral into non-traditional substance abuse treatment settings, such as medical settings and other community settings. Our evaluation efforts did not include some of the college grantees that you've heard about today, but this first cohort of grantees, California, the Cook Inlet Tribal Council, which is in Anchorage, Alaska, and the states of Illinois, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, Texas, and Washington. And on the right, you see some of the settings that we are looking at for the evaluation, including hospitals, EDs, trauma centers, and community health centers. Our cross-site evaluation efforts did not focus on folks under 18 years of age, so we didn't look at the school programs or student assistance programs. The purpose of the cross-site evaluation design is to examine the implementation of various ESPER models. It's really the first time that we've gotten to see some of these research models being implemented into really large real-world settings, and it's given us a chance to look at the different types of models that people have implemented the ESPER programs into. And we've also been able to look at the economic impact and costs associated with ESPER implementation, and there is a coexisting patient outcome effort that sort of parallels the GIPR data collection that Jack talked about. And the folks at RTI are handling that piece of it. This is a little pictorial of what the cross-site evaluation project looks like. Again, there's the process evaluation, which establishes the sort of overall evaluation context that allows us to interpret that GIPR data and the patient data that we're collecting. There's an outcome evaluation, again, that's that parallel data collection for a subset of patients that is using a common screening tool. It's using the ASSIST. This first cohort of grantees were able to choose an evidence-based screening tool, and it didn't have to be the same across grantees. So we're using the ASSIST for a subset of grantees that will allow us to compare with the GIPR data to look at outcomes, since this is not a randomized trial. We're really just looking at real-world data, administrative data, as Jack talked about. And then there's an economic evaluation that provides information about cost, cost-effectiveness, and cost-benefit. But again, I'd like to focus on the process evaluation effort. We are collecting both qualitative and quantitative data that support both of these quantitative data collection efforts. We really are interested in describing how the different grantees have implemented the general ESPER concept from the research phase into real-world settings. We are organizing performance data so that implementation models can be compared with settings across the different ESPER components, and this really provides deeper insights into the implementation barriers and facilitators and the real-world challenges of implementing ESPER that you've heard about today already. So how have we collected data for the cross-site evaluation? We have obviously looked at documents, proposals, annual reports, technical assistance reports. We've conducted two site visits to over 25 performance sites in the seven grantee states and tribal organizations. These grantees have over 60 implementation performance sites that are in the field right now. We've conducted about 200 semi-structured interviews with the state key stakeholders, with SBIRT administrators, and with also direct service delivery providers, with the health educators, with the social workers, with the folks who are actually doing the SBIRT services. We've also conducted about 200 observations. We've shadowed 200 SBIRT folks who are doing the screening and the brief intervention and referral services. And these data have been entered in the Atlas database, and we are continuing with quantitative data collection that is GIPRA-like data from each of the sites. And as Jack mentioned, we have over 600,000 folks that have been screened, and subcategories of those that have been provided brief intervention and brief treatment and referral services. This is the way we like to visualize the kind of SBIRT project. And what we're seeing with the implementation is that basically states are using three different implementation models that you see in the front. Most states actually propose to use what we're calling an in-house generalist model. And that is a model in which in-house medical staff would do the screening and the brief intervention components of SBIRT. The in-house specialist staff we're calling a model in which the grantees have pulled folks with behavioral specialties such as health educators, chemical dependency counselors, social workers, behavioral health counselors, and paid part of their salaries to do some of the SBIRT services. And so that's kind of an in-house model with specialist staff versus generalist medical staff. And then the third model is what we're calling a contracted specialist model, and that's what you heard the California folks describe, where there's an umbrella organization that does the training and the supervision and makes sure that the health educators or the chemical dependency counselors are certified and perform these services in a reliable fashion and then put them inside the medical settings to actually do the services. So those are the three different models that we've been able to see across the sites that I don't think has really been sort of described before in the literature. So I think this is going to make a valuable contribution to the general SBIRT field. And of course, you see the different service delivery areas across the top. Some states have, let me give you the next slide. This is what we're finding, that for screening, about five grantees are using contracted services such as the CDPs, health educators, behavioral health counselors to do the screening. And this is not what most proposed. So this has been an interesting sort of migration of, since the beginning of the SBIRT projects, I believe you guys proposed your contracted service model to begin with, but other states did not. About two grantees are still using in-house generalists, actual medical staff, RNs, medical assistants to do the screening. Most grantees are now using the contracted services for brief intervention. Only one state are using general medical staff to do the in-house, using in-house specialists to do the brief intervention. And all grantees are using contracted specialists to provide the brief treatment and the referral services. This is a slide that talks about the service delivery components. Which states or which grantees are doing what with respect to pre-screen and screens. All of the states proposed evidence-based models. Most states have moved now to using pre-screen questionnaires because it's too time-consuming to use the larger screen. So that's kind of been an interesting shift. As the previous presenters have mentioned, most are using the audit and the DAST. The new grantees that we're not covered to evaluate are required to use the assist now, but these grantees use the audit and the DAS for the most part. For the brief intervention piece that Jack described, they're using either an NIAAA model, the FRAMES model, which is an evidence-based model, or some kind of combination with motivational interviewing. And then for the brief treatment piece, we either have cognitive behavioral therapy mixed with MI, motivational interviewing models, motivational interviewing treatment, or community reinforcement approach. Okay, so this is what we're seeing across grantees. With respect to barriers, we broke these up into the different models because there are different barriers that kind of go along with these different implementation models. With the in-house generalist model, we see that most of the barriers refer to the generalist's lack of time, the medical staff concerned that the presenting patient's problem either took too long, you know, to deal with and they weren't able to kind of fit that in, or it didn't really relate to alcohol or drug use. Some generalist medical staff are uncomfortable with the substance abuse topic, and there's a high turnover rate of folks who do the screening, the nurses, the medical assistant staff, and so you're constantly retraining new folks, and that kind of goes with the rotation of residents and teaching settings too. They get them trained and all of a sudden they're on to the next hospital. The facilitators, we've heard always the strong champion is important. Many medical staff that we heard from during our site visits really stressed the need for adequate time to have staff buy-in and adequate training and direct supervision where they're getting feedback about how they're doing or they're able to watch somebody do a screening or a brief intervention seems to really help. Medical providers, hospitals, they like to see outcome data. So whenever that data are fed back to them, that seemed to be a facilitator in getting folks to do the interventions. And then combining expert services, this again was focused on alcohol and illicit drug use, but it fits with tobacco use, it fits with depression, it fits with other screening assessment and feedback that they may be more used to doing. So that was also a facilitator. With respect to that in-house specialist model, using in-house specialist staff to do the expert services, sometimes it was difficult for them to come into an ED or trauma setting if they weren't used to working in that setting. They're not part of the generalist staff, so sometimes we heard about turf wars until those things kind of settled down. The specialists were oftentimes expected to do their other work, and so there was a split between the expert work and the tasks that they typically do, and that caused some management or in-house administrative issues that were problematic. Some of the facilitators, including, again, the champion buy-in from frontline staff especially, regular team meetings that crossed over with the generalist and the specialist staff were helpful. And one of the things that was really interesting is that referral piece that we keep hearing about. It's so difficult to get folks once they've been referred to specialty treatment. We're finding with the specialist model and with the contracted model, the brief intervention services or the brief treatment services were actually brought onto the medical setting sites. So rather than saying, let's hook you up, you know, 20 miles down the road and you have to take this bus and, you know, you're going to wait in a long, you know, queue to get your treatment, these services were brought into the setting, and we saw that state after state after state, which has been very, very interesting, and a higher connection with brief treatment in those states. For the contracted service model that Michael and Ray described, again, in the beginning, they're really not part of the medical team. These are folks being brought in from the outside, but that seems to dissipate over a relatively short period of time, and they become part of the medical staff talked about them wearing the white lab coats, and after a while they do fit in and they take over a lot of the burden from the medical staff, and that seems to kind of wash out in a very short period of time. Again, people who don't work in medical settings, it takes a while for them to get used to the medical culture. One of the things we heard from physicians is with some of the substance abuse folks or health educators that come into medical settings, they're not used to providing direct feedback to primary care docs or generalists or ED docs. They want that feedback loop, and so they've had to learn to do that. And of course, there are reimbursement or insurance issues with folks who are peer educators or health educators that may be problematic in getting reimbursement for those services. Some of the facilitators, that contracted model isn't affected by organizational issues. If there's staff turnover, if the hospital's sold, that they're still there and they're still working under a different umbrella. They're supervised under a different team, and so those sort of outside problems don't affect that model as much. They're constantly monitored, as you all talked about, for reliability of service delivery. And again, once again, they can deliver on-site services rather than referring folks out. We have seen some migration from, I don't want to say from the evidence base, but basically migration of what was initially proposed to sort of in response to real-world issues. We've seen these full-length screening assessments that were originally proposed being changed to shorter pre-screen assessments. We've seen this traditional substance abuse delivery being put on site in hospitals. We have treatment counselors actually going up to hospital rooms, providing the first and second sessions of brief therapy. The alcohol and drug risk factors we've seen with expanded screenings for some sites, especially the low-flow sites. Some of the rural sites are adding tobacco, comorbid site factors, other health risk factors, rather than having a screener sit around and wait for the next substance abuse patient to come in. So that's been something that we didn't expect to see, but makes a lot of sense. SAMHSA has required that grantees keep up with a certain level of screening. It's easier to find a lot of people in hospital and ED settings. So we've seen states that initially proposed working in federally qualified health centers or community health centers expand to hospital settings. And again, we've seen this movement from the in-house generalist model, which is really where the research base is, to these contracted service models, which again is sort of another interesting finding for us. The prospects of widespread adoption, and this is a key factor. SAMHSA set up these five-year grants in hopes that it would give grantees enough time to think about sustainability and really keep these wonderful programs going. And that was one of the quotes that we heard over and over, that they thought that SAMHSA's five-year funding would be one of the biggest contributors to the sustainability. It would give the states enough time to integrate with specialists and to determine how that, you know, they would sustain their salaries. And the reimbursement issue, which is the last slide, obviously is part of that. We did hear again with our interviews that we need to include other risk factors. These risk factors don't travel alone, and many patients have other issues that aren't addressed just by the ESPRT program, and we're seeing an expansion of that in our site visits. And again, funders want data. So the states that really had very strong research folks who could feed this data constantly back to the hospitals or the federally qualified health centers really have been able to make a case for keeping the program up and running. So in sum, what we think we found from our early process findings is that ESPRT has provided services to a wide variety of individuals who would otherwise have received no services. As Jack mentioned, these are people who have never been screened, many of whom have never been referred to treatment or been linked to treatment. So that obviously is a wonderful finding. For this first cohort of states, we've seen over 60 sites implementing these very complex public health programs in a variety of settings and a range of settings. One thing we did hear again over and over was that screening for risky substance use has greatly improved the organizational and clinical connections between medical settings and substance abuse treatment agencies. You know, docs typically don't know how to refer folks, and now that really has kind of closed that gap, and that I think is something that's an important finding. And someone mentioned, how do we get folks into treatment, and that is one of the next analyses that our team is working on. Grantee models have been classified, as I mentioned. We really haven't looked at different implementation models, and that probably relates to the larger translational healthcare literature. We've identified many barriers and facilitators to implementation, and we have seen migration from these research-based models, but it has occurred in response to real-world challenges. So many of the research base uses clinical folks to implement ESPRT in clinical settings, and this is the first time we've really had the opportunity to look at the translational efforts on a large scale basis. So it's been very exciting, and I thank you for your time.
A couple minutes for questions, and I'll start right here.
I'd like to thank the panel. My name is Gilbert Kihara. I'm from Honolulu, Hawaii, and I am the ESPRT counselor in the trauma center. It's doing really well. We're in a pilot project. All the presenters, I had all these great ideas that I could take back. The problem that I'm having is the brief interventions.
Mm-hmm.
Has anyone experienced any positives?
So I'm just going to repeat the question. Has anyone found any good techniques to do follow-up with a methamphetamine population?
I just want to say that we're experiencing the same thing. You know, our population of the emergency rooms, there's just so many people that we can't get a hold of. We're experiencing the same thing. We've tried everything. You know, one of the things that we're trying to do is stagger or phone call people so that we can call them twice a day. Really, once we find out, once we make contact with them, we have a better chance of giving them more doses of free treatment. But it is difficult. I feel your pain.
And Jack, you want to add to that?
It's clearly a unique problem that we've been experiencing with the methamphetamine problem. And just an FYI, in mid-November, SAMHSA's hosting a policy seminar where we've identified state teams. I know Hawaii is actually participating in that. We're bringing in teams of key policymakers to actually take a closer look at how, in fact, are we addressing the methamphetamine problem on state, tribal organization level. The outcome of that, I think, might actually shed some light on that. We've definitely taken a lot of learnings from what's happening in Los Angeles around the use of marketing techniques to really engage people more so, and I think more to follow on that line. Thank you for raising that, though.
Yes. Michael?
Various models in various settings, because I think that's the piece that's missing.
So the question was about the sustainability and the economics of sustainability, and Bonnie's response is that those data are still being looked at, but will be part of the final data analysis. Okay. And Michael, you want to add to that?
When we were looking at the polls and to activate and decode, we looked at what we were experiencing as far as the cost of the screening and the intervention. And so we based our projections on those types of cost data. Mind you, it's still very sketchy, except it was definitely good.
Okay. I have time for one more question, and I'm just going to mention that James Turner is standing in the back of the room, and anyone who wants to sign up for SAMHSA grant announcements, check in with James, and he has a system in place for to do that. And yes? Yes.
Screening brief interventions being embedded into other systems such as child protective services. Bonnie, from what I understand in our current evaluation, none of the sites are actually, all the sites are more medically based, but that is clearly the future of ESPRT. There's no doubt about that. I think we're looking forward to embedding ESPRT into other types of systems. I was impressed that Michael's highlighting the involvement in the criminal justice system, and I think that's the wave of the future.
And what I did mention was that we're currently working with our Department of Social Services so that screening takes place within the social services system as well.
Great. Congratulations.
And I'm sorry to have to end this session, but maybe people can come up and ask the speakers individually their questions or with that, whatever group gets together here. Thank you. It was a lot of great information.
Right. So we don't want to get, we don't have to go back and do that.